Brothers in the Dharma, we need to begin where Satyaraja suggested we begin this afternoon, with expressions of love and respect and of faith. So I'm going to begin this talk by just saluting the Prajnaparamita. Om Namo Bhagavatyai Arya Prajnaparamitayai. So, Om, homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. And the perfection of wisdom is a Bhagavati, a goddess. She's in feminine form and she's there gazing upon us rather imperiously, as the perfection of wisdom must do. And it's very important that we, as we enter the realm of the perfection of wisdom, that we enter that devotional realm and that mysterious realm, that real realm of otherness, the realm of a mysterious, elusive goddess, a Bhagavati, an Indian goddess who is the mother of all the Buddhas, the Prajna, the Jinamata, very, very mysterious indeed. I'm not going to say any more about that. You'll have to just open to that. But it's important to start here, because sutras in Buddhist tradition are not books as we know books to be. We have a book which you can now get in a bookshop, which has the Vajracchedika Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Diamond Sutra that cuts like a vajra. And, you know, there are so many Buddhist books that you can get. But the sutras, of course, were originally an oral tradition that were passed on by word of mouth and were heard and only written down much later. And they become, in a way, this whole world, this whole spiritual world, and they're regarded as being like mantras, really. Sutras are words of magical power. If you recite a sutra, something happens. Something happens to the cosmos. Something happens to the world around you. Something happens to you. This is all sutras. Even the it's not just the Mahayana. The Pali Canon is regarded as having that same kind of sanctity, that same kind of power. And of course, the sutras traditionally were carried. Yes, they were carried physically, but they were carried in the hearts of men. They were walking sutras, if you like. And in the Mahayana, particularly, there's this figure, this mysterious figure in some ways, but very important institutionally, known as the Bhanaka, the Bhanaka, the reciter, and the preacher or the teacher of the sutra. These were hugely important figures and regarded as, like saints, men of great sanctity, carrying the sutras, carrying the word of the Buddha and communicating them to the people. And of course, because it's an oral communication, the streams of oral communication mean that the sutra is alive. In a way, sutras, they become closed when they become written down. And it's good, thank goodness, they got written down for us. But they wouldn't have been closed for a long time because, you know, in the stream of orality, in the stream of oral tradition, you get more and more coming into the whole communication. So we're talking about something alive, something living, something that carries the transcendental wisdom of the Buddhas, the liberating wisdom of the Buddhas for us. So it's wonderful that we're having the Diamond Sutra recited again here at Padmaloka. I don't know if there is a lot of sutra recitation in our movement these days, or perhaps there's been very little. That's a great shame. And perhaps we need to revive it. You know, I got an email the other day from a Dharmacharini in Manchester saying that on a Padmasambhava festival next year. She and her friends want to recite the whole of the life and liberation of Padmasambhava. I thought, well done, sadhu. That's what we want. And reciting is a very interesting word. I think it literally, if you look at the etymology, it means resituating. Recite, you resituate the living sutra in this time and this place. That's what we're doing with the Diamond Sutra. We're resituating the timeless wisdom of the sutra into this place, so that the timeless affects this time. So it's very, very important, this business of how you approach the sutra and how you, well, you need to revere the sutra. In some of the Perfection of Wisdom texts, they even give quite a lot of detail for the ritual worship of the sutra. It's very, very good that we've got the sutra on some lovely cloth here. Again, we're following tradition, but you know, they say incense should be burnt and perfumes, you know, sort of offered and all sorts of things to the sutra. And it's not just a book. This is important. It's carrying. It's the crystallization of the wisdom of all the Buddhas. And it's also said that where that place, where the sutra is recited, it's a blessed place. And those who listen must have enormous merit. So great, you know, great, great potency is given to the sutra. And it's interesting that Bhante himself has a deep, deep feeling for sutras. He follows in the tradition. It's interesting as well, just to mention, that the Diamond Sutra itself has had a huge effect on the course of Buddhist history. The illiterate wood gatherer, Huineng, who became the sixth patriarch, heard the fifth patriarch reciting the Diamond Sutra, and he heard these words: therefore then, Subhuti, the Bodhisattva, the great being, should produce an unsupported thought, that is a thought which is nowhere supported, a thought unsupported by sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. When Huineng heard that, he was enlightened, an illiterate woodcutter. Never heard the Dharma before, apparently. And he heard those words, and there was this tremendous illumination, and he went to the fifth patriarch, who said, yes, you have understood, but now it's, what was it, 7 years of rice pounding. And you can take that sort of literally and metaphorically, 7 years of rice pounding after the initial vision. But that's the sutra. He's overhearing it. He didn't go to the recitation. He was an illiterate woodcutter. He overhears the fifth patriarch reciting the sutra. So the sutra has this sort of power. And of course, our own teacher, like I said, had this great love of sutras. Sutras are incredibly important in Bhante's life. All of the different traditions, the Pali suttas, the Mahayana sutras, different sutras. He carried on his sutra reading and listening to sutras, well, right up until his last days. He was always, you know, any new translation that came out, he wanted to have it read to him. He was so eager to do that. And in his life, if you read his life story, there are so many occasions where he's pondering deeply a sutra. There's a meditation retreat where one of his notes in his notebook is that I saw the deep spiritual significance of the White Lotus Sutra in meditation. He realized the significance of the lotus, the Saddhama Pundarika. He talks about his preparing his lectures on the Sutra of Golden Light and how the four great kings who are in that sutra actually visited him while he was preparing the sutra. And it's clear when you hear his exposition of the Sutra of Golden Light, a very obscure sutra, and his exposition of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, he's absolutely absorbed in the sutras. In many ways, Bhante's more like a kind of Chinese Buddhist master than perhaps a Tibetan Buddhist master because of his absorption in sutras. In Chinese Buddhism, the sutras are much more have much more prominence than in Tibetan Buddhism. They know about the sutras in Tibetan Buddhism, but the tantras are more important for Tibetan Buddhists. But in China, the Mahayana sutras especially are extraordinarily important. And in many ways, Bhante brings that to us, that absorption in the realm of the sutra. And of course, it was on reading the Diamond Sutra itself that he realized he was a Buddhist, and he always had been a Buddhist. 16 years old in Tooting in South London with a very early, perhaps not that accurate translation of the Diamond Sutra, and something happens. I'll just read you what he says. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arhats, saints who have attained individual nirvana, are said to become confused and afraid when they hear of it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the truth taught by the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known and believed and realized it ages before. And the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be one, and that I had never been anything else. After offering two, this is from the history of my going for refuge, after offering two possible explanations for my feeling that I had always been a Buddhist, I went on to describe my experience of the Sutra of Wai Lang, Sutra of Hui Neng, which I wrote threw me into a kind of ecstasy whenever I read it. The truth taught, this is the crucial point, the truth taught by the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra and to a more limited extent by the sixth patriarch in the Sutra of Wai Lang was, of course, the highest truth of Buddhism, so far as the truth can be expressed in words. The truth of shunyata, or voidness. The truth, that is to say, that the phenomena of existence are ultimately non-different from absolute reality, and absolute reality ultimately non-different from the phenomena of existence. I'll repeat that. The truth of shunyata, or voidness, the truth, that is to say, that the phenomena of existence are ultimately non-different from absolute reality, and absolute reality ultimately non-different from the phenomena of existence. So he says, his comment on that, his Dharma eye had opened to some extent. But that's the way he encapsulates his realization of the truth of the Diamond Sutra, that there's no difference between absolute reality, shunyata, and phenomenal existence. I mean, I've read this many times, and I'm just beginning to realize that is quite a statement. That's his, if you like, essential teaching of the Diamond Sutra. The truth of shunyata, or voidness, the truth, that is to say, that the phenomena of existence are ultimately non-different from absolute reality, and absolute reality ultimately non-different from the phenomena of existence. Wow. So I want to try and go into that. Because that's quite something. And that's my teacher's, our teacher's essential summary of the Diamond Sutra, isn't it? That's the sort of summing up of the sutra that we're listening to. That's the sort of fundamental insight. That's the Dharma eye opening, the non-difference of shunyata and absolute reality. You could even say, if you want to put it in sort of more sort of personal terms, the non-difference of sentient beings and Buddhas. You could put it like that, the non-difference of unenlightened sentient beings and fully enlightened Buddhas. Goodness me. You know, we really are on dangerous ground perhaps here, but that's really what he's saying. It's interesting, isn't it, as well, when in his later commentary on the Diamond Sutra, you know, it opens with the scene that we had read to us beautifully by Padmasagara, where the Buddha is at Shravasti. He goes, you know, he's staying at Jetta Grove and Atapindika's Park. He wanders into Shravasti in the morning to beg his food. He returns, after eating, he washes, and then he sits with his mindfulness set up in front of him. It's a wonderful description. It's very like a sutta that you might read in the Pali Canon. There's no fabulous descriptions of bodhisattvas from other world systems. There is a huge gathering there of arhats and bhikshus and bodhisattvas, but there's nothing, you know, fabulous and fantastic like you find in the Lotus Sutra or in the Sakavati Vyuha Sutra or the Vimalakirti Nidesha. It's a very plain and simple framing of the sutra. And of course, Bhante, in his seminar on it, he says, well, it's saying that it's here. It's here in the everyday that we realize this sublime truth, that we realize this non-difference between absolute reality, shunyata, voidness, and the phenomena of everyday life. It's here and now. So it's wonderful that Satyaraja is reading Ryokan to us. I think that's such a wonderful thing to be doing in relation to this, to really to help us to move into this realm, into this territory. So we have to, you know, start to try and open that up, because of course what the sutra is really all about is the life of the bodhisattva. This whole business of the non-difference of voidness and ordinary phenomena is where the bodhisattva has to be. And, you know, the opening dialogue that you know, Subhuti comes forward and very respectfully and reverentially worships the Buddha, and he does that wonderful rejoicing in the Buddha, and there's that wonderful expression, you know, how much the Tathagata, the Buddha, has favoured the bodhisattvas with the greatest of favours, and so on. It's a beautiful, sublime sort of line that of course the bodhisattvas, you could say, are the Buddha's heart sons, because the bodhisattvas are going to become Buddhas like him. They are his true disciples. They are going to rediscover enlightenment when it has been lost. They're going to practice this path over innumerable lifetimes. These are the great spiritual heroes, so of course the Buddha is going to favour them, you know, with his special blessings. He's going to, you know, do that for them. And then Subhuti wants to know, but how do they discipline themselves? How do they train? In what way do they train to follow this bodhisattva path? And the Buddha describes the arising of the bodhicitta and the bodhisattva vow, that the bodhisattva has to have this sense of each and every single living being throughout the entire cosmos, those with form, without form, with perception or non-perception, egg-born, moisture-born, born from a womb, all these different kinds of beings. I take that to mean, you know, each and every one of us. This is why I think Metta Bhavana in all its stages is very important. You know, you've got to, it's not all beings is an abstraction. All beings are made up of particular beings who stand out. So the bodhisattva has to develop this extraordinary consciousness that takes in each and every single kind of being. He knows their suffering. Of course, so that's why they all need to be led to the nirvana where there is no remainder, where there is no more suffering. That's really what is being said there. The bodhisattvas generating this mind, generating this consciousness, the bodhicitta, to lead all beings to that place where there is complete and total liberation from all suffering. And yet, even though all beings have been led to nirvana, no being has been led to nirvana. Because if the bodhisattva in the first place forms some sort of notion of a self and other, himself, themselves, or a soul, or a life force, or a personality, he would not be a bodhisattva. This is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, and it's, you can have all sorts of fancy explanations about it. I could have a go right now. But in some ways, I think it's much better to just be left with that. Just be left with that. But one thing is very, very clear. It's what's very, very clear about this is that the bodhisattva's not just a kind of cosmic social worker. Not that I've got anything against social workers, and I'm sure a cosmic social worker would be incredible. Or rather, the bodhisattva is a cosmic social worker, but with the profoundest realization of the voidness of all beings. Of the voidness of all beings and the voidness of himself. And what does that mean? What kind of effect does that have? You know, it changes everything. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, we mustn't have this idea that the bodhisattva sort of charging around, getting all sort of anxious about people and, you know, pulling them into nirvana and so on and so forth and, you know, worrying about it, having sleepless nights about it. He would not be a bodhi being if he was doing that. He's deeply relaxed, deeply calm, dwelling in the voidness, dwelling in absolute reality, and yes, leading all beings to nirvana at the same time. Very, very difficult, very hard for us, impossible for us probably to understand the nature of a bodhisattva, but absolutely crucial that we hold that in mind. Especially in a movement like ours, you know, where we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, taking the Dharma out and reaching people and meetings and organising and being very concerned about this, that and the other. I'm very concerned about. Especially in our environment, we need this bodhisattva. We need this sense of absolute reality, if you like, working itself out for the liberation of all life, deeply relaxed and deeply calm, and yet incredibly active. I remember, you know, being with Bhante in India that time after I came back, and Bhante was amazing in India. The extraordinary thing in India, when it was his first time back, and all these lectures, thousands of people, you know, in different parts of Pune, and lots of individual meetings with people, and he's so relaxed. He was so relaxed, speaking in Hindi, really tuned into people, wonderful sense of humour, ordaining people. And I remember this retreat we did, the ordination retreat up on this, the top of this old hill fort synagogue, the Lion Castle, the Lion Mountain, made famous by the great Maratha hero Shivaji, fighting Aurangzeb and the Mughals, and on the top of this mountain there were these bungalows where we had our retreat. And when Bhante wasn't doing anything, he sat in this bare room just gazing out at the blue sky and the brown coloured bare mountains all around. He just sat there doing nothing, completely at ease. And yet everything was happening, you know, to bring about the transformation of our friends in India. A remarkable kind of example of living this life. You know, there was nothing to do. Everything was happening. Everything had been done. So he could just enjoy the vast, deep blue Indian winter sky and these brown mountains, and just sit there completely at ease. So, yes, perhaps there's nothing more to say. Perhaps I could just leave you with that image. But there is a little bit more I want to say. I want to try and explore this business of how of the non-difference between sentient beings and Buddhas, the non-difference between absolute reality and the phenomena of existence, where our practice actually is in the day-to-day. I want to go into it. I want to explore it with reference to a short passage in the Diamond Sutra. But to get to that, I have to tell you a story. Sutras are interesting things because they gather up other sutras. And in the Diamond Sutra, you find that. You find references to all sorts of other things. And one of them is to a very famous story. And it happened a very, very long time ago. So it's a once upon a time story. And the story begins with the king of Kalinga, King Kali, king of Kalinga, and his harem. Him being a great Indian potentate, he had lots of queens, lots of young women, and he wanted to go off to the jungle. You know, maybe it was the rainy season, I don't know. That's the sort of love season in India, where the jungle's very lush and the peacocks are singing, and you know, you've got the blue sort of thunder clouds. You know, that this is sort of, you know, in later Indian tradition, this is Krishna's time. You know, this is the time of dalliance. So off they go into the jungle with these gorgeous young women and this powerful king. And they have a bower somewhere, and you know, we don't quite know what they get up to, this being a Buddhist text. They don't go into a lot of details. But after a while, the king falls asleep on a couch. A couch has been brought, and the young women, they're a bit bored, so they decide to run off and just go and play in the jungle. So they run off gathering flowers and, you know, putting them in their hair, and you know, maybe they're playing hide and seek. They're having a wonderful time, these gorgeous young women. And they stumble into a hermitage. They stumble into a hermitage, and there's this man seated in meditation. A very, very, very beautiful rishi. You know, a very, very beautiful holy man. You can imagine lovely brown skin, you know, radiant, and you know, really, this whole atmosphere of gentleness and sanctity and love, basically. And he's seated there, and the girls come in, and they just stop, and they're just enchanted and attracted. And they said, "Well, who are you?" And the man said, "Well, people have called me Kshantivardhin, the teacher of Kshanti, the teacher of patience, because all I practice, I've just practiced all my life, I've practiced patience and love and compassion and benevolence. And in every talk I give, I always teach patience. I always discourse on patience." And he proceeded to teach them all about patience. And the young women, they're just enraptured at this beautiful man, his proper guru, teacher, teaching about patience with all this beauty. And they're enraptured. Meanwhile, good old husband King, he's woken up and he looks around, and his lovely young women are not there. So he asks an attendant, "Well, where have they gone?" He said, "Well, they ran off that way." So he wants to find them. So he marches, and it was pretty obvious where they'd gone because he could see, you know, where they tramped and broken through the jungle. And of course, he stumbles into the hermitage. And he sees this beautiful man, this beautiful rishi, teaching patience to these lovely women who are utterly enraptured. They've forgotten all about him, the king. And, you know, they're just absorbed in listening all about patience. And the king is absolutely enraged. I mean, he's absolutely beside himself. I mean, he's so angry. He's jealous. He's completely jealous. You know, how dare they go off with another man? You know, of course, this is India, you know, and, you know, women, you know, going off unaccompanied with a man, that's, you know, who's not their husband, that is a bit dodgy anyway. But he's absolutely beside himself, and he's just angry. Presumably, he's also noticing the absolute serenity and calm of Kshantivardhin, who doesn't change. You know, when this powerful king sort of bursts in, he says, "You know, do you know who I am? Who are you?" You know, and Shanti Vardhan explains, you know, who he is. And the king says, right, we'll see if you're the teacher of patience. We'll see if you're the practitioner of patience. You know, what about this? And he chops off his hand. Still practicing patience? And Shanti Vardhan is just really calm. I mean, he chopped off his hand because he just put his hand forward in the gesture of fearlessness, because he could see that the king was frightened and suffering. He responded with compassion. Anyway, off came the hand. Are you still practicing patience? And he is. All right, what about this? And, you know, one by one, he chopped off all of his limbs. After each bloody cut, he asked the same question. Are you still practicing, Shanti? And it was always yes. Always yes. He was absolutely unmoved from this state of calm and patience and forbearance and love and metta and peace and compassion. Shanti has all of those qualities. And in some stories, the king is, you know, something happens. The king is, of course, shocked, and magically Shanti Vardhan's body comes back together again. And, you know, he forgives the king and the king repents and, you know, everybody's happy. In other stories, he just is reborn in a Devaloka. And of course, Shanti Vardhan was the Buddha in a previous life. This is from the Jatakas. This is his period where for many, many years he practiced Kshanti, the perfection of patience. Kshanti Paramita, one of the six perfections that comes after generosity and Sila and comes before Virya and Dhyana and Prajna. Kshanti Paramita. And it's a wonderful, you know, very, very beautiful story. And probably in India, I don't know if it's identifiable now. Just to say, just again, to bring out this sort of sense of the sort of sanctity and sacredness of things, there was probably a pilgrimage site in India sacred to this incident, Kshanti Vardhan's shrine. You know, when we recite the places in which the bodhisattvas have been in the puja, that's said to be associated with the different pilgrimage sites to do with the Buddha, the Buddha's previous lives, which are all situated handily all over northern India. So it would be lovely to know whether it's still there, or the remains of it are still there. So I want to go into patience as a way of practicing the Diamond Sutra. Practicing the non-difference of voidness and ordinary everyday phenomena, the phenomena of existence. I think Shanti is, you know, very, very underestimated. We talk a lot about generosity, we talk a lot about ethics, we talk a lot about virya, talk a lot about meditation, and we talk a lot about wisdom. Interestingly, Shanti isn't given that much attention, is it? Which is perhaps significant. Perhaps it's a bit subtle for us. Perhaps it's a bit too challenging. Perhaps it's hard to really go into. Perhaps it's a bit close to the phenomena of existence. Perhaps, you know, it's there that our practice, you know, really needs to be if we're going to bring the voidness, absolute reality into our lives. As I've said, I think Bhante in one of his lectures, he thinks Kshanti is one of the most beautiful words that there is in Buddhist literature. Yes, you can translate it as patience, you can translate it as forbearance, but it also has connotations of love and compassion, gentleness, benevolence, and spiritual receptivity. It's also a word for wisdom. In the Prajnaparamita literature, they often refer to the Prajnaparamita as this Kshanti. This patience is the perfection of wisdom. So let's just look at a few areas of where we can practice this, and then refer to the Diamond Sutra. And then we'll come to a conclusion. So first of all, the first area where we have to practice kshanti is to life itself. We need to bear life. We need to be non-retaliatory to life, non-reactive to life itself. Because there are so many things that we need to bear in life. If you like, kshanti is the skillful response to dukkha. It's the first skillful, creative response to dukkha. So this life, you know, whether we like it or not, we're going to get sick. We're going to be in pain. We're going to find the weather difficult, either too hot or too cold or too grey. There will be pandemics. There are all kinds of irritations in life. We can just go through them all of the sort of, as it were, just the stuff that goes with the deal of being born a human being. We have to bear with it. You find in the Pali Canon, these short suttas, I could never work out why they were in there, because they're so short, where you'd have a monk seated in meditation, and it would say he'd be suffering. He'd experiencing painful vedana due to his, you know, it's the sort of ripening of karma from a previous life. It might be illness, it might be whatever. It doesn't really matter what the cause is, but he's sitting there in pain, but mindfully and clearly aware. There's no ill temper, there's no restlessness, there's no distraction. There's clear comprehension sitting there, bearing it. And the Buddha will frequently say, bear it, bhikkhu. Bear it, bhikkhu. This is a common expression that the monks that would use with one another. You can imagine it. You know, in those days, there's no paracetamol, there's no ibuprofen, there's no painkillers, no antibiotics. You can imagine the sort of sufferings that the people would have. And they're constantly be told, bear it. You have to bear it like the earth. I think in some etymologies, kshanti is related to the word for the earth. You need to be big like the earth that can hold up everything. So sometimes we've just got to do that. We have to do that. And it's so, I suffer a bit from physical pain of one kind or another. And I notice how irritable I get. You know, I sort of want to find fault or lash out, or, you know, even with inanimate objects, you know, and, you know, or processes to get through. Like, I mean, just changing my trousers seems really annoying, you know. It's sort of pathetic, really, isn't it? But you know, it's all to do with learning to bear with all this without resentment. This goes with having... It's nobody's fault, it's not your mummy's fault, it's not your daddy's fault, it's not Boris Johnson's fault, it's not anybody's fault. It's life. It's dukkha. And the best thing you can do is bear with it. Shantideva talks about being like a block of wood or being like a tree stump. It sounds, people worry about this, oh, I sound really alienated. It's not, it's actually really positive. It's just you're not reacting. You're bearing it, you're holding it, like the good earth, the great earth that has to bear everything. Sometimes we have to do this. We can't get the positive going. It doesn't. Seemingly we can't. This is the positive. To bear it. You know, there you are. I mean, it also happens, you know, with Satchakirti came to see me the other day. He just led. I hope you don't mind me talking about this, Satchakirti. It's very positive. He just led a big weekend. He'd had a really big week where he was doing three or four different jobs. And then the news came that somebody had been here and tested positive. And, you know, I could see, I know that feeling. It's like, what next? You know, what's going to happen? It's not fair. I could see it sort of, I could see him kind of bearing it. And we had a bit of a talk, and I think you did bear it, and you slept on it and came magically the next day with a solution. But it was one of those moments where you could have gone, I think, maybe either way, but you went the right way. You bore it nobly, like the great earth, and then the next day came the creativity. A wonderful example. Wonderful example to me of how to respond when suddenly you've got that curveball from life just belting you, where it's so tempting to shout at somebody or chuck something through a window or do something, sort of fire off that email that you've always meant to do to tell somebody they are really are a complete idiot. Or as Eddie might say, you know, pull somebody's arms off. I mean, he doesn't do that anymore, but because he's a Buddhist. But sorry to get so personal tonight, guys, but, you know, we are talking about voidness being non-different from, you know, and sentient beings being non-different from unenlightened beings. So I think I can get personal. You can get personal with me later. So we have to bear things. This is the first thing we have to bear. And yes, we also have to bear, with people. You know, in a way, you know, and people are the most difficult to bear with of all. People who annoy us. Sometimes they annoy us. They haven't actually done anything to us personally. We don't like the way they walk. We don't like the way they've done their hair. You know, we don't like the clothes they're wearing. We just don't like them. You know, I've actually heard people say to me, I just don't like him. You know, as if that is justification for actually hating him. You know, and for actually judging him as a really basically not a good enough human being. So why are we wasting our time on this person? Believe me, I've heard people talk like that. You can admire the honesty, can't you? But, you know, it's not a good way to live, especially as a Buddhist and in a spiritual community. That is not a good way to live. You've got to get over your likes and dislikes, especially your dislikes, you know, and not react. Be patient. Look more deeply. And of course, it could be that sometimes somebody really has a go at you. They really take a dislike to you. Maybe they dislike you because you're a Buddhist. You know, maybe they want to attack you because they don't like the way you're living your life. You know, maybe they really want to have a real go at you or the community that you're in. That might even be somebody near and dear to you, maybe even somebody you're living with. They don't like the fact that you're a Buddhist and become very, very hostile and antagonistic and attack you. There's people in life who we think are really bad people and doing bad things in the world. And it's very, very tempting to feel justified in our anger and hatred towards them. And that if we don't have anger and hatred, we're sort of letting them get away with it. This teaching of Kshanti is saying none of that is acceptable. None of that is acceptable. I think all Buddhists really need to do a serious meditation on Kshanti, because I think that there are Buddhists who justify their anger towards people in society and in the world. Ideologically justify it, that it's okay to attack those people. It's okay to, you know, and I'm not talking about any, I've got no, you know, no political allegiance at all. I really don't. But you see it. Sadly, I see Buddhists getting into taking up ideological positions and being antagonistic. This is wrong because it's not Kshanti Paramita. It's not the perfection of patience. It's got nothing to do with love and compassion and bearing with what other people do and what they don't do. It's not either advocating a kind of passivity. I think this is really important. You know, in the story of Kshantivardhan, he's not passive. It might sound as though he's passive, but he actually puts out his hand in the gesture of fearlessness. His response is compassionate. He's seeing that king burning already in a hell of his own creation. And his response isn't to take up a position in relation to him. It's, in a sense, to take up a non-position outside of the framework in which the king is operating. Kshantivardhan is coming entirely from wise love and compassion. He sees that he's suffering. He's deeply suffering. That's the response that we should have to one another. Deep love and compassion for one another's suffering and the suffering in the world around us. And we've got to find this within the confusion of the modern world. We have to go to this place of Kshanti. We have to, you know, Kshantivardhan, what was his practice of Kshanti? I presume he just spent hours and hours in metta bhavana, hours and hours in bearing with, you know, all of the dukkha of life, hours and hours not reacting, you know, to the people around him, but always seeing their suffering, always seeing their ignorance, always seeing that they need a path, they need a way. This is what we should be doing as Buddhists. This is the real Dhamma revolution. This is the revolution, actually. This is the deep human revolution, to live in this world of Kshanti and to communicate it to others. So much more to be said here. And we practice it on a day-by-day basis in relation to, yes, all the irritations and difficulties and burdens that come to us, you know, within, you know, just through being alive, and in the responses that we have to the people around us and the world around us. Constantly putting aside that reaction, that payback, that vengeance, forbearing, and seeing that they're suffering, seeing that they're ignorant, seeing that they don't know what they're doing, and responding with love and compassion and benevolence. And practicing, you know, you can also practice non-violence, ahimsa, which means that you just do not respond with any kind of violent agitation or anxiety in relation to what's happening, but move to that place of deep peace in relation to what's happening. We have the practices. We don't need to teach, you know, sometimes, well, how do we do this? The metta bhavana is all this. It's all in the metta bhavana. It's all in the just sitting. It's all in the mindfulness of breathing. It's all in the Diamond Sutra. And of course, there's this other level. This other level, this sort of wisdom level in the Diamond Sutra. It says, moreover, Subhuti, the Tathagata's perfection of patience is really no perfection. This suddenly comes in the sutra. Moreover, Subhuti, the Tathagata's perfection of patience is really no perfection. And why? Because, Subhuti, when the king of Kalinga cut my flesh from every limb, at that time I had no perception of a self, of a being, of a soul, or of a person. And why, if, Subhuti, at that time I had a perception of self, I would also had a perception of ill will at that time. If I'd had a perception of a self, I would have had a perception of ill will. And so, if I had a perception of a being, of a soul, or of a person, with my super knowledge I recall that in the past I have for 500 births led the life of a sage devoted to patience, then also have had no perception of a self, a being, a soul, or person. And he goes on in that way. So this is the level that we need to get to with the practice of patience. So what does that mean, not seeing the person? How do we practice this? Does it mean that they vanish, they're not really there? And of course it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that, you know, the king really does chop Kshantivardhan to pieces. But of course, the mere fact that Kshantivardhan sees a being suffering, seeing he doesn't see a being of hatred who he retaliates to, the fact that he sees that he's a being who is suffering, actually he also sees he's a being with potential. I mean, there's another story that says that the king of Kalinga became Kondanya, one of the Buddha's first disciples. So he's seeing him, in seeing his suffering, in seeing his ignorance, he, as it were, humanizes the king of Kalinga. He sees him as a human being with the potential to be something different. That's my way into this language of not self. It's not that there's nothing there. I'm sure there are deeper ways of seeing it, much less wordy ways of seeing it. But what you're really seeing is that the other person is a person of absolutely unbounded and unlimited potential. And your compassion is for that. It's not just for their suffering, not just for their suffering in the usual sense. It's the suffering of their limitation, that they're unenlightened and that they could be enlightened. So the preacher of patience, Kshantivardin, the teacher of patience, sees the potentiality of everybody around him. So that's why there's non-retaliation. This being who's killing him is a mass of energy, a mass of energy to be liberated onto the path. It's interesting, I was writing out a text for Padmavasa that I'd found, a Padmasambhava text. It was Padmasambhava's account of his studies and training with a great Dzogchen master named Sri Singha. And Sri Singha gives him a teaching. Padmasambhava goes off, has all sorts of realizations. And in one retreat, after the teaching from Sri Singha, he realizes there is no difference between sentient beings and Buddhas. Absolute non-duality. Goes back to Sri Singha, very pleased, and Sri Singha said, "What have you learned?" You know, very, very tough teacher, really, you know, "What have you learned?" "I've realized that all sentient beings and Buddhas are non-different, they're non-dual." Okay, pretty good. "But you know what that means, don't you? That means you need to honor all sentient beings as if they are Buddhas. That's the practice, if you say it's all non-duality. Each and every single being, yes, that person who's burnt the toast, if you've realized non-duality, they are a Buddha, worship them. Worship them, honor them, treat them with the greatest possible care and love and attention. That's what the practice of non-duality really means. It's practicing shanti, it's practicing patience, it's practicing, in this sense, the holiness, the sacredness of, you know, all of life around us. So Kshanti Paramita involves this movement to this state of, well, they call it the Anuttapaka Dharma Kshanti, the patient acceptance that all dharmas are unproduced in the first place. All dharmas, all beings are unproduced. I don't really know what this means. I've been meditating on this for decades. I came to the conclusion recently in meditation, forget about the unproduced bit. It's the kshanti that's important. It's not about whether or not your backache is unproduced. What's important is that you bear it. That's the starting point. Forget all the fancy terminology. Be with what's happening and be with it with compassion and understanding. Put it in a wider context. I think I'd just like to, and I'm going to bring my talk to a close in just a moment, put it into a context of another teaching from the Perfection of Wisdom of Bhante's. This is from his exploration of the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata Prajnaparamita. This was the Perfection of Wisdom, which is the collection of all precious qualities, probably the oldest Perfection of Wisdom text, which was one of the first seminars he ever did here. He really wanted to try and open up what the practice of wisdom, Perfection of Wisdom, really is for people in their experience. Again, trying to see the non-difference of all phenomena and absolute reality. And he approached it by talking about metta, by talking about wisdom as aesthetic appreciation, Because if you see with wisdom, you don't see things and people in terms of how you can use them. Most of the time we go through life seeing one another, seeing the world around us, in terms of how we can use the objects, the people, what they can do for us, even, you know, how they can help us in our spiritual life. It's all incredibly utile. That means it's full of attachment and craving and self-interest. You're not seeing them as they are. You're not seeing them with the softness and gentleness of patience. But Bhante said, if you see people with metta, you see them as beautiful. You see everybody and everything as beautiful. So metta is an entry into the perfection of wisdom, because you start to see people emerging as they are in themselves. Or you could say as they are without themselves, in the sense that you're freeing them and you of a very fixed way of seeing them. You're seeing the beauty of their spiritual potential. And you enter, he says, the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. And our whole life needs to be in this vast circle of aesthetic appreciation, of genuine selflessness. And all of our little activities, even our worthy activities, need to be in this vast context of great beauty. That's living the perfection of wisdom in everyday life. He said, he gave examples of, I mean, sometimes people think this teaching means, it just means sitting in a chair and doing nothing. The things he mentioned about dwelling in the greater mandala, he said, meditation should be dwelling in the greater mandala. On this retreat, we've got a great chance of doing that, particularly with the just sitting, of dwelling in this greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. Chapter meetings should be places in which you enter the greater mandala. I think some order members would find that quite shocking that Bhante said that. Going for refuge groups should be places in which you dwell in this greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. You know, we can go through, in fact, our whole life needs to be pervaded by this quality of awareness. When that is there, then we really have a chance to practice the perfection of patience. You know, forbearing, not retaliating, bearing with, but also loving and responding, you know, to others, and especially responding to their spiritual potential. So I want to end this talk with a couple of quotations. To try and really, it's very, very hard, I think, to see what patience and this absolutely unconditional response of forbearance is like. It's very hard to even find it in Buddhist literature. I'm going to read actually from a Sufi text, which I think is absolutely wonderful, which I think really conveys what goes on. To do with not even seeing that there's a fault in the first place. It's an exposition from a Sufi commentary on the one of the names of the truth, Allah, in other words, the compassionate, the merciful. And it goes like this: when the ocean of mercy bubbles up, every slip comes to nothing. For the slip was not, and the mercy always was. How can that which was not, then was, stand up to that which has always been, and always will be? When the ocean of mercy surges with generosity and forgiveness, all slips and mistakes go back to non-existence and nothingness. For the slip was not, and mercy and compassion always are. How can was not stand up to always is.